From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Today, surprise, Detroit City Council President Brenda Jones is launching a last-minute write-in campaign for Congress. The reaction from her fellow Democrats?
It's just crazy.
Then two interviews from the 6th Congressional District, incumbent Congressman Fred Upton.
They want to see what you stand for, and frankly, it's often a strength when you disagree with a party line versus a rubber stamp.
And his Democratic opponent, Matt Longjohn.
People are so worried, not just about what health insurance will be there for them, but even if they have insurance, how they're going to continue to afford it.
Plus, rock band MC5 helped set the stage for Detroit's punk scene. We'll talk about how the city shaped their sound.
The ashes were still hot from what was happening in the city in 67.
Those stories and much more. From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Let's start today in Michigan's 13th Congressional District. This is Detroit and surrounding cities. It is where Democrat Rashida Tlaib is running in November's election. But now, surprise, it has been confirmed that Detroit City Council President Brenda Jones, also a Democrat, is going to run in the election as a write-in candidate, as an independent. This is after Jones lost to Tlaib in the August primary. But what makes this even more interesting, Jones won a special election in August to finish out the final 2 months of longtime Congressman John Conyers' term because he resigned. Jonathan Kinlock is chair of the 13th District Democratic Party. Jonathan, what is going on?
Oh, boy, I've been asking myself and many others in the 13th District have been asking ourselves that since we heard the news that Brenda Jones had decided to run against as an independent against Rashida Tlaib while she's on that same ballot herself as a Democrat for the unexpired term. So it's just crazy.
So explain what happened. Like, I guess I sort of thought, okay, Rashida's, you know, we were all sort of going, there's not a Republican opponent in the 13th. There's a couple of independent candidates. So it's sort of like, oh, well, this is going to be the next Congresswoman. What made any idea Brenda Jones decide to jump in?
The fact is that Rashida Tlaib will be the next congressperson for the full term. It doesn't make any sense on the surface. Just using conventional wisdom, it makes no sense for her to actually be running as a write-in candidate, also running as an independent against the Democratic nominee. On the surface, it makes no sense. But I did receive a call this morning where someone said that she was actually filing her affidavit as a candidate, as a write-in, I should say, so that she could find out on election night how many individuals actually wrote her name in, because votes cannot be tabulated unless an affidavit is actually filed with the county clerk.
T.J. Buchholz, who's Rashida Tlaib's campaign spokesperson, posted on Twitter on Monday, quote, successful congressional write-in campaigns generally require three things, money, time, and work ethic. If you can't check at least two of those three boxes, don't attempt it.
And that's the truth. That is absolutely the truth. But for some reason, Brenda Jones has decided that she's going to run as a write-in in a race that everybody, you know, who has been working and engaged in this whole political process clearly knows that she doesn't have a real chance in 7 to 6 days to actually win an election as a write-in candidate. It's just amazing the direction that she was chosen a week out. So I don't understand. I have not spoken with her. It makes no sense. But like you said, it's definitely fodder for the political wonks.
Let's say it truthfully, the 13th Congressional District has not been one without these kind of crazy stories, it feels like, here and there.
Well, listen, we've been topsy-turvy with news stories, with resignations and all sorts of stuff in the 13th District, especially over these past 12 months. You know, you just add it to the list of giggles, I should say.
Yeah, well, so I guess my question is, I mean, Brenda Jones has name ID, though, right? I mean, she is the city council president. She won this term in August. There's still some debate of whether she'll take it because whether she can be seated as a congresswoman for this short term and also stay as city council president, but she's got name ID. What's your feeling when you talk to Democrats in the 13th in Detroit and these cities around? I mean, is there a possibility that folks might go, you know, yeah.
Name ID matters when your name is on the ballot. She is going to be a write-in candidate who basically announced 7 days out that she's running as a write-in candidate. We love to believe, as you know, when we're on these radio shows and quoted in a paper, that the whole world is listening and paying attention. But that is not the case. Most voters are not going to hear that she's a write-in candidate. You have to take into account the fact that a large number of absentee ballots have already been cast, sealed in envelopes and mailed back to the city clerks. I don't think there's going to be a major education move or any resources that's going to come Brenda Jones' way to make her campaign as a write-in for U.S. Congress a viable one.
Former President Barack Obama was at Cass Tech on Friday trying to push for voter turnout in the city. What are things looking like? You must be hearing things, absentee ballots and things like that in Wayne County. What are you predicting?
I'm predicting that Democrats will turn out and Democrats will win up and down the ballot. This blue wave is real. But also I see on the ground where you have not only the Democratic Party, but you have a number of organizations who have been engaged in this election to push towards a larger voter turnout. So you have a lot of folks, boots on the ground, a lot of activity taking place in Wayne County and specifically in the city of Detroit. So I do absolutely feel that there's going to be a sense of urgency by the voters in casting their ballots. So I definitely agree that we're going to have a successful next Tuesday.
In fact, I'm looking at the numbers now compared to 2014, where there were 112,000 absentee ballot requests. As of now, or last week, I should say, 168,000. So we are seeing an increase there in Wayne County.
Yes, we're seeing an increase in Wayne County, and I'm hearing a lot of excitement this year regarding these candidates. And more so, folks want their voices to be heard. So a lot of people, I believe, are going to turn out on Election Day and cast their ballot. So President Obama coming last Friday was added plus, not to mention that you had, which was very interesting, on Friday at that same rally, you had Brenda Jones and Rashida Tlaib on the same stage and was talking about unity, unity, unity. And then now look at us talking today about what's going on in that race. So that's pretty interesting. And so you never know what's around the corner.
Jonathan Kinlock is chair of the 13th District Democratic Party. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
This summer, the U.S. Coast Guard reversed a long-standing policy and waded into a labor dispute that threatened to hold up a big-ticket industrial project. Stateside's Joey Horan has this look at the long-term effects the decision could have for unions working on the Great Lakes.
For 13 years, Terrence Clemens loaded and unloaded cargo at the Toledo port. He worked for Midwest Terminals. The company leases and operates the International Cargo Dock, owned by the Toledo Port Authority. Clemens was fired in the spring of 2017. He's one of many to lose work in a labor dispute that is now in its eighth year.
It's all about discrimination, about what's really going on. It's really a mess up in there.
In May, members of Clemens' historically black union set up a picket line on the Maumee River. They were trying to get the attention of lake pilots bringing cargo into Midwest terminals. These pilots are responsible for navigating ocean freighters on the Great Lakes. And the dock workers wanted them to know, hey, there's a labor dispute here. Don't bring ships in. It worked. Overnight, international shipping into and out of Midwest terminals seized up. And it stayed that way the whole summer.
By shutting the port down to ocean traffic, has sent a message unequivocally to all the Europeans, don't send your ship to Toledo because there's labor problems.
That's Bill Yockey. He's a large Irish guy, a former pilot with enormous hands and a foul mouth. He now runs the International Longshoremen's Association, Local 1982.
Most of the time, if you've stopped a ship for 3 or 4 days, the white flag of surrender goes up. Where do we sign? What do we got to do to make this go away? And away it goes, okay? That didn't happen here. Didn't happen.
The resulting logjam threatened to disrupt the construction of the Cleveland Cliffs Iron Plant, a potential major player in the Great Lakes steel industry. Here's Paul Toth, President and CEO of the Toledo-Lucas County Port Authority.
We couldn't get into a situation where labor was leveraging the pilots to stop progress. That was really the biggest concern of our community, making sure that we open this port back up and not really affect that project.
The problem lay in an arcane Coast Guard directive known as the Admiral Hen Letter. It's important to note that lake pilots are independent, but they work for associations that are regulated by the Coast Guard. Under the Hen Letter, lake pilots had autonomy to decide whether to honor a picket line. And Tulse says they were, all over the Great Lakes. So over the summer, he met with local, state, and federal politicians to warn them about how he thought this rule was threatening economic development. Soon, the Coast Guard was flooded with letters from these very officials urging them to reverse the Hen Letter. It all came to a head at a September meeting. Bill Yockey from the Longshoremen's Union was there.
It was well orchestrated. It was like going to a New York production of How to F*** Us.
Following that meeting, the Coast Guard issued a letter canceling its 1994 instruction. The agency declined multiple interview requests. The bottom line? Lake pilots are now required to cross picket lines. Here's Captain Dan Gallagher, president of the Lake Pilots Association.
You got to understand, we have a charter that is issued by the United States Coast Guard. And if we don't file the directive of the United States Coast Guard, pilots could be sanctioned and or the association could be stripped of its charter.
Their choice is to either cross a picket line, you know, which is an activity that has some expressive and political content, or to lose their livelihood entirely.
That's Wayne State University labor law expert Sangjukta Paul. She sees the Coast Guard's action as a clear threat to pilots' First Amendment rights. Valdemar Velasquez, a union organizer and board member of the Port Authority, thinks the stakes are even higher. He says when you engage the Coast Guard to intervene in a local labor dispute,
I think we're flirting with fascism.
But for the longshoremen who just want to work, this is all a bunch of noise. The pilots have their jobs, the ships are coming in, the plant is being built. Yet they are still out of work and might be out of options. From Toledo, Ohio, I'm Joey Horan for Michigan Radio.
Still to come, we'll celebrate the 50th anniversary of the MC5, Detroit's musical bad boys.
I think over time, especially Detroit, has come to understand the importance of MC5 and the influence that they had on other bands in the area, but also just like the greater rock and punk aesthetic and community, you know, across the globe.
That's up next. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in today for Cynthia Canty. 50 years ago today, the MC5 performed the first of two shows at Detroit's Grandy Ballroom for their Kick Out the Jams live recording. So let's hear about this group that helped set the stage for Detroit's punk scene. Paul Young is the founder and publisher of Detroit Music Magazine. He calls the MC5 one of the most infamous and celebrated groups in Detroit music history.
Yeah, that's right. And it wasn't always true. But I think over time, especially Detroit, has come to understand the importance of MC5 and the influence that they had on other bands in the area, but also just like the greater rock and punk aesthetic and community, you know, across the globe.
Young recently spoke with Cindy about the many issues that inspired the MC5's music.
There's going to be some young folks listening who may go, what, who, when? tell us how and when the MC5 got started. Give us a sense of the span of their career.
Yeah, and I'm going to have so much fun going through all this because the history is so rich and deep, and it's been covered a lot, and shamefully, I will pitch the fact that I'm writing a book about the history of Detroit's punk music scene, and this is a huge part of the story that I'm making sure that I get right. But they started in 1964, and the original lineup is Wayne Kramer, who's still with them today. We're going to talk a lot about him. Fred Sonic Smith, Rob Tyner, Michael Davis, and Dennis Thompson. And they have a new adjusted lineup now, but they're celebrating the 50th anniversary of their debut and live album called Kick Out the Jams. And Kick Out the Jams was recorded over two nights live, again, in Detroit at the very famous Grandy Ballroom on Devil's Night and Halloween in 1968.
Wow, that is hard to believe. And we will be listening to that. We're going to make you all wait a little bit for that. Because we're first going to start with a choice you've made for us, Paul Young, and that is the MC5's cover of John Lee Hooker's song, Motor City is Burning. Let's take a listen. This one?
One of the big reasons was I'm lucky enough to have already seen the MC50 show. I saw it here in New York, and Wayne Kramer spent a lot of time in New York after he got out of prison, which you can read all about in his new book, The Hard Stuff, but he was working with bands and punk groups in the area, including the infamous Gigi Allen. But when I went to the show, he talked a little bit backstage about the Detroit influence on MC5 and why the MC5 became what it was and how it got there and what Detroit's influence had on the group. And I'll quote him here, but part of what he said was the success of the auto industry was a big motivator or a big influence on the group. And he said, guys moved up from the South for those good union jobs. Factories were 24/7, three shifts a day. And these young guys had money. They wanted to go to clubs. They wanted to have a beer and they wanted to dance. They wanted to hear music and it was great for musicians. He also says, a lot of families were making good money and could afford electric guitars for their kids, and that was me.
Wow.
He also went on to say that he came up in the city that was a boomtown where all things were possible, and the Great War was done, and it was good to see the USA in your Chevrolet. But with that, he said, my generation grew up with a kind of pissy attitude because we saw a lot of what they were talking about wasn't true for everyone, that people of color and the poor were not sharing in the great prosperity of America.
And you have Vietnam going on with that. You have the rebellion of 1967. So there was a lot of churn.
A ton. And actually, as you just alluded to, John Lee Hooker's version of the song, which was on his album Urban Blues, it was written by Al Smith, but it was written in 1967. So this was about something at the time when both John Lee Hooker and MC5 recorded this song. The ashes were still hot from what was happening in the city in 67.
Mm. Now, we're going to move on to the next song, but before we do, you have to explain to us, what is Rocket Reducer number 62?
Yeah, so my understanding is that at the time, it was a solvent, it was a chemical thinner that was available at hardware stores, and the rumor is that the band would give that a sniff before some of their live shows.
What jumps out at you with this track?
In my opinion, this is actually like the standout track of this album. I just think the dueling solos, between Smith and Kramer, along with just like the crazy feedback, I would argue that this sonically may be the strongest song on the album.
And now to the track that is arguably the best known the MC5 turned out. I'm going to tell you a story. When I was in school in the 60s, Catholic school, somebody lined up the MC5 to play at our sock hop, at our dance. And the good nuns got wind of the opening line, kick out the jams, followed by a two-word epithet that began with mother and ended with a word that would get me fired. So I can tell you that dance was quickly and decisively canceled. So what do you hear, Paul Young, when you listen to Kick Out the Jams?
Yeah, I mean, this is like the rallying cry, obviously. A couple things interesting that you mentioned at that beginning. That was such a huge deal at the time, as you just pointed out, that Hudson's, the big Hudson store that we actually just celebrated, I think the 20th anniversary of the building going down, but the big Hudson store, they refused to sell the album. And so Elektra Records, that they were on at the time, put out this big ad in the paper that was just a picture of, I believe, Rob Tyner, and it just said, you know, F Hudson's, ultimately. And then the logo of the record label. But that was just part of what launched them into that infamous, you know, kind of lore that they enjoy now. But another part is the Kick Out the Jams, actually, that line. A lot of people think it's kind of like this protest call, but according to Kramer, it was really what they yelled at bands that were on stage before MC5 to tell them to, like, wrap it up and get out of here and give us our turn, ultimately.
I love it. And you can just tell from that, as you say, a key part of Detroit's punk rock scene, even going back to the 60s when this song was stirring so many nuns and others up.
Huge. And they ended up being a massive influence, and they laid a lot of groundwork for bands like the Stooges and the Up and, you know, a ton of others. And hopefully we'll finally be able to see them in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which I know a lot of music people think it doesn't matter, but I think it does in a sense that these guys have paid their dues. They're legendary performers and recording artists, and some of them are no longer with us, and I think they deserve it. But this is their third time being nominated, so I think 2018 might be the year. And less than a year ago, we were on your show talking about people that we thought should be in the Hall of Fame from Detroit.
Yep.
And this was our number one, so...
One of the most infamous and celebrated groups in Detroit music history, the MC5, and those words from Paul Young, founder and publisher of Detroit Music Magazine. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Before Election Day, we are speaking with Michigan congressional candidates. We're going to hear today from Michigan's 6th Congressional District. We'll start with incumbent Republican Fred Upton. He was first elected to Congress in 1986 and is seeking another term. He spoke with Cindy Canty last week, and Cindy asked him what his priorities are for another term in office.
Well, I have a lot of things on my plate. I can keep you a long time, but immediately, we got it. You know, as I travel around our district, people don't really care if you have an R or a D next to your name. They want the job done. So I've always been bipartisan, whether it's protecting the Great Lakes, whether it's protecting our pipelines, whether it's more infrastructure, working together to solve the nation's problems is something that I've done. I've got experience having worked as a firsthand on constituent service, and I've had the experience working for a president, President Reagan, way back when, on legislative issues that have helped me as I chair now an important subcommittee, but chaired the Energy and Commerce Committee as well to get things done.
This election is often called a referendum on the president. What has President Trump done in his nearly 2 years in office that you support?
Well, I have not been afraid over the years to either agree or disagree with any president, regardless of party. President Obama signed some 200 bills that I moved through the committee, obviously bipartisan, since I'm a Republican, he's a Democrat. I've not been afraid to disagree with this president on a number of issues either, whether it's when he tried to eliminate funds for the Great Lakes Restoration Fund, Charlottesville, Muslims, immigration, a whole number of different things. So as we look at this election, people really, they want to see what you stand for. And frankly, it's often a strength when you disagree with a party line versus a rubber stamp.
What do you support?
Well, I support where we are on the economy. You know, I can remember when we lost a million people from Michigan and their kids as well. We had unemployment 12, 13, 14%. Literally billboards in my district from the Indiana governor saying, "Michiganders, come on down. We've got jobs for you and a better way of life." That's now changed. We've got growth rates now at 4%, maybe even going higher. We've got unemployment at record lows. Businesses, large and small, their big issue is finding folks that want to work. I teamed up with John Dingell way back when to save the auto industry, working with both President Bush and President Obama to get that thing done. We have a lot of tool and die, with a lot of auto parts suppliers over here in Southwest Michigan. They wouldn't be here had we not worked together to get things done.
I know you voted for the tax cuts. Did those tax cuts do enough to help the middle class, in your view?
Well, you know, the middle-class tax cut, not only did it reduce the rates, providing about $3,200 per per household in terms of take-home pay that they didn't have before, but doubling the deduction, the standard deduction, doing a number of different things. It lowered utility rates because, of course, the utilities are required to were required to reduce those rates because the corporate tax rate went down. So we saw a real impact on particularly middle-class families when we reduced the rates for all. And it helped generate the 4% growth rate that we're now experiencing today.
Now, the Treasury recently announced the final deficit for the fiscal year that just ended is up more than $110 billion from last year. And the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget recently calculated that over one-third of that deficit was due to legislation enacted by Congress. What are your thoughts on the ballooning deficit caused by the tax cuts?
Well, a couple things. First of all, we did collect the Treasury did get more income than ever, record level of income from personal income taxes because you had more people working and therefore paying taxes. But you got to remember a big element of that increase in the deficit, it came because of the hurricane. We spent $100 billion that we didn't think we were going to have to spend because of the hurricane that hit Puerto Rico, Florida, and Texas. So that all came, you know, in the fiscal year, and it all had to be spent. And without that, the deficit would have been about the same as it was before. And frankly, because we've literally doubled the growth rate now, we've got more people working, more people paying taxes, and a much better economic climate than ever before. At the same time, the president signed bipartisan legislation that most of us in Michigan voted for, regardless of being a Republican or a Democrat, that in a established a ceiling for all spending for not only fiscal year 18, but also fiscal year 19, which meant we didn't have a shutdown. That's a good thing.
Now, Senator Mitch McConnell recently talked about cuts to entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, as a way of addressing...
Not happening. Yeah, that's not going to happen. I think his comments were a little bit taken out of context, but that's not going to happen. I am on the Social Security caucus. I support COLAs for our seniors. I'm opposed to Medicare cuts. There's not any momentum to see changes made. And frankly, shouldn't never happen without bipartisan support. And that's just, it's just not in the cards.
So then what do we do about the ballooning deficit?
Well, again, we had a budget agreement. We actually need budget reform. I'm one of those that believes that we ought to have a two-year budget instead of a one-year budget so that we can get through some of these stops and starts on annual appropriation spending bills. But that's a little bit of an inside game. But at the end of the day, we need a budget that Republicans and Democrats can support, and we ought to live within those means. And, you know, as you look at a percentage of GDP, as you look at revenues that are coming in, I think that there's plenty of areas where we can find some common ground that still protects our vets, our seniors, and our defense.
As you've just joined us, I'm talking with Michigan's 6th District Congressman, Republican Fred Upton, running for another term after 16 terms in Washington. I'm going to touch back on something you alluded to as we started talking. In a recent televised debate with your opponent, you said you are not 100% on board with the president. What specifically issues are you in disagreement with his administration on?
Well, we can look at nearly two dozen different issues where I've disagreed with the president. And, you know, again, I've got a long track record of agreeing or disagreeing with any president, regardless of party. I oppose the elimination of the Great Lakes Restoration Fund. He wanted to eliminate that. So whether it's fighting the Asian carp, whether it's water quality, we as a delegation, as a member of the Great Lakes Caucus, we stood up in a bipartisan way to restore every penny of the fund that he wanted to cut, not only for fiscal year 18, but also fiscal year 19. I'm one for immigration reform. I think that we can have border security. We need that, but we also need to have a pathway for our folks that are here, particularly our Dreamers. I believe strongly in free but fair trade, but I'll tell you, these tariffs, which really impact the auto industry if they're fully put into effect, would be very detrimental to jobs here in Michigan. And so I've joined with more than 100 of my Republican colleagues in a letter to the president saying that he needs to cease and desist. The statements on Charlottesville, I was an early one out of the box to say that those comments were inappropriate. And as I look at, you know, some of the awards I've gotten, I was named the Michiganian of the Year by the Detroit News. Why? Because they work with both sides of the aisle, whether it's on gun safety, whether it's school safety, a whole host of issues. I know that there's room where we can work together, and I have a record to show it.
And you have served 16 terms in Washington. I'm wondering what still motivates you to want to keep doing it, keep working for West Michigan?
Well, I'm a hands-on guy. I had the opportunity to run the constituent service operation for a congressman before me way back when. I had the opportunity to work in the Reagan White House, where I developed some legislative skills. Again, a Republican president with a Democratic Congress, and he had a great agenda that the American people loved, which is why he won 49 states when he ran for reelection. I've used that experience to really stand up for the people in Southwest Michigan, whether it's creating jobs, whether it's having the right environment, protecting our Great Lakes, even issues of helping veterans and folks trying to get disability on Social Security. I've done all that with my two district offices back here and want to continue that job. We still need that experience to make sure that things get done.
Republican Fred Upton, Congressman from Michigan's 6th District. Thanks so much for talking with us on Stateside, Congressman.
You bet. Thank you.
And running against Congressman Upton is Democrat Matt Longjohn. We will hear from him next. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside here from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in today for Cynthia Canty. In the run-up to Election Day, we've been bringing you interviews with statewide and congressional candidates. We heard earlier from Republican Fred Upton, the incumbent in Southwest Michigan's 6th Congressional District. Now we turn to the Democratic candidate, Matt Longjohn. He, too, spoke with Cindy last week, and she asked him why he wants to replace the 16-term incumbent Republican Fred Upton. Here's what he had to say.
It's time. Time for a new generation of leader in Washington representing Michigan's 6th District. Mr. Upton has been here for 32 years, and quite frankly, I just think that his record is catching up to him, and it's time for some new leadership.
Well, when you say his record is catching up to him, particularly what are you talking about?
Yeah, last summer, in May of 17, Mr. Upton played a pivotal role in advancing the national effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act and replace it with who knows what. He wrote the Upton Amendment. He didn't just vote to cut coverage for pre-existing conditions or essential health benefits. He actually put his name behind an amendment that would have cut coverage for nearly 40,000 people in Southwest Michigan and 23 million people across the country. People have now figured out, I think, over the last 10 years, just how important it is for pre-existing conditions to be covered by every insurance product and to waive coverage for those conditions and essential health benefits was something that I knew was wrong. I think many people knew was wrong, but Mr. Upton was willing to advance that bill to keep up with party leadership in the Republican House. And that's one of the votes that he's cast that I think has changed the direction of this election.
His amendment would have made $8 billion available in states that sought the waivers. What was your reaction as far as what that meant to Michigan?
As someone who's spent nearly 20 years in health innovation, public health, health administration, nonprofit administration, you know, on one hand, $8 billion sounds like a lot, but given the experiences I have, I knew it was a drop in the bucket. And it signaled to me that it was nothing other than a political play that Mr. Upton was making. You know, $8 billion sounds like a lot of money, but we spend $3.2 trillion a year in health care. And for people with pre-existing conditions, many of whom may have experienced periods of insurance coverage that was not sufficient for them, those costs mount very quickly. $8 billion was a token, a political token amount of support for people with pre-existing conditions. In fact, when the Senate Republicans received the bill from the House Republicans, the next day, the conservative Republican majority in the Senate said that that number had to be at least $165 billion. So for those of us who were kind of watching that bill, who had spent time working on things like Medicare expansion and assuring people had good coverage and patient protections, when we saw $8 billion, we knew what was going on, and that was that Mr. Upton was playing politics with people's lives.
What qualifies you, Dr. Long John, to represent the people of the 6th District in Washington?
Well, first and foremost, this is the community that I love the most on the planet. It's where I grew up. I'm a fifth-generation member of this community. On my mom's side of the family, folks walked here in 1861 and put down roots on the family farm. My dad's side of the family is a large family here in Southwest Michigan. My dad actually had 47 first cousins here in the district. You know, I'm raising my kids here. They're the sixth generation of family here. This is my home. And I think when we look to those who we want to have represent us in Washington, that's an important factor. I love the people and the community here in Southwest Michigan, and I think that's important. The second factor is that I've spent nearly 20 years building coalitions to get things done on policy. I've never been a politician or a lobbyist. I've been a subject matter expert on agricultural policy, transportation policy, education policy, health and healthcare policy, and always as the white coat or the scientist coming in to help share information with policymakers about the direction of policy. I built coalitions to identify policies that needed to change, structures that needed to be built, programs that needed to be expanded, and then worked with policymakers to make sure that those things happened. So I've been in the guts of policymaking on a variety of topics for nearly 20 years, been successful. In fact, led one of the very first ever projects that demonstrated that community jobs focused on preventing illness could save lives and save Medicare billions of dollars. So my team actually already helped to expand Medicare by creating billing codes and all the different kind of intricate things that you need to know something about if you're going to be in Congress and working on healthcare policy.
As you go around this district that you have such deep family roots in and you're talking to voters, what are you hearing from people? What's the biggest concern or problem that people in the 6th are talking about?
Health and healthcare issues dominate many conversations. People are so worried, not just about what health insurance will be there for them, but even if they have insurance, how they're going to continue to afford it. The cost of health care, the cost of health care insurance is deeply troubling to many families here in Southwest Michigan. You know, beyond that, what I hear on the doors and on phone calls and in various meetings with people and groups of people across the district, that people are really generally frustrated that you know, wages haven't increased in 30 years, real wages, that economic opportunities for their kids are fewer and farther between, harder to find, that people are working harder and harder to make ends meet and still unable to keep up with the rising costs of education or health care and unable to plan for things like dignified retirements. People here are looking for reasons to think that the political system is going to change, the economic system is going to change, and put people in front of corporate interests or party leadership.
What do you think the 6th most needs from Washington? I mean, if elected, what would be the first thing you would dive in and tackle in Congress?
Yeah, I think one of the most important things that we need to address sooner than later is campaign finance reform. We need to make sure that those who represent us in Washington have not been bought and paid for by dark money or corporate interests. That influence shows up in everything from healthcare policy, where folks like Mr. Upton have protected pharmaceutical industries over patients, over people, where in our tax policy, corporate tax cuts have been made permanent while individual tax relief was only temporary and, again, shows that corporations are getting the better part of the deal over people. But beyond campaign finance reform, obviously health reform is a significant issue for me. We need to improve healthcare quality. We need to reduce healthcare costs. We need to make our healthcare system more patient-centered and equitable. And the other thing that I think is really vital that we take up and work on in the next Congress is making sure that our environment is a larger part of our policymaking agenda. You can't live your healthiest possible life in a toxic environment. as people in Parchment and Flint and Otsego and many other places around the state now can attest to. Mr. Upton voted to actually take away all regulatory authority for the EPA to monitor clean air. That's just not the kind of environmental stewardship that we want and need, I think, in Congress.
There is a tremendously deep, deep partisan divide in this country, certainly in this state. How do you think we get past that?
I think that we need to focus on people. We need to focus on what the majority of people need to have high-quality lives. I try and oversimplify it, I know, but I boil it down to heartbeats. You know, everybody wants more of them, and everyone wants a higher quality of life. Quality of life is measured by your ability to make ends meet, to provide for the basics for yourself and your family, you know, without having to have three jobs to make that happen. We want to make sure that we're in a healthy environment, that we have good education opportunities and livable wages. And those kinds of things, if you boil it down to people's heartbeats or personal finance, household budgets, are what people really want relief on right now. And we have to focus on putting people first in all policies, people's health and quality of life first in all policies, I think, to get around some of this very partisan gridlock. If we focus on people instead of donors or partisan points being scored in the halls of Congress, I think we can make a lot of progress. That's what I've shown over 20 years of working on things like children's nutrition and diabetes prevention. There are as many Republicans as Democrats who love people with diabetes. And by focusing in on the issues that matter most to most people, I think that we can get around some of this partisan gridlock.
Democrat Matt Longjohn, who's running to unseat Representative Fred Upton in the 6th Congressional District in Southwest Michigan. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for the time.
We are now 1 week from Election Day. And to better understand the issues that are most important to you, we've dispatched reporters and producers throughout the state to ask you two questions. One, what are the most important issues for you as a Michigan voter? And two, what concerns you most about our political climate right now? From now until next week, we will be bringing you these answers in a segment called Voter Voices. Today, we start with Eugene Albright in Adrian, Michigan.
I am concerned about the election. I'm for the moral issues, and I also believe that our country can be turned around if we go the right direction. And I believe we're headed for the right direction. And we need somebody with guts, and we've got that.
My name is Fran Chabray. I live in Hamtramck, Michigan, and I work for a security company. A very important issue is water. People getting shut off and people having their water bills go up because of things happening in other places is just wrong. Everybody needs water. The way I see politics in America today is it's in a bad state. And it's unfortunate because this is a beautiful, wonderful country. And it's just taken a bad turn.
Special thanks there to Mike Blank and Rozzy Joffrey for recording those interviews. So the pumpkins are carved, the skeletons might be on the lawns. It is the perfect time of year for a creepy, spooky, haunting ghost story. And Dwight Stackhouse has a good one for us. Dwight goes by Skip, and he participates in the Secret Society of Twisted Storytellers in Detroit. He's also a Kresge Fellowship recipient. Here's a story from his time with the Jehovah's Witnesses.
I find humanity enjoys a good scare. You know, I'm not that person. I don't have the scare gene. It's not one of those things that appeals to me. And so I thought of this story I'm going to tell as more a bit of history, almost, if you will, anthropological, more than a scary story. But I think it's only spooky if, while stretching belief, there's something in it that makes it believable. But I never question people's memories anymore because, you know, when people say, oh, Skip, come on, now you made that stuff up. I'm like, it doesn't matter to me if you believe it. When I was there in that room, It was startling. It was terrifying. There is another world out there, far beyond your mind and imagination. And there is a world within this one, above it, beneath it, surrounding it. A spooky, unknowable place that terrifies the senses. We have fantasized it with stories of ghosts, goblins, demons, and spirits. Halloween. I am sure most people have a ghost story of their own, and today I'm going to tell you mine. It is no longer true, but in 1969, I was a very serious Christian minister, studying the Bible with a young man who had a very interesting background. He was the son of a woman who was a good Christian herself and had recently died, and she had wanted all of his adult life for him to give up the streets and come home to the Lord. A real challenge given that he had instead become a pimp, a hustler, and addicted to heroin. He also had a very strange ability to communicate with pigeons. All birds, but especially pigeons and parakeets, which he kept in cages and attended to lovingly. This man had been in some very dark places, and somewhere along the way, he entered the dark kingdom of Beelzebub, Satan, the devil himself. And he had been captivated by the demons of Beelzebub and could not break free of the grasp. On a particular day, he called me frantically with a dreadful crying. "They're killing my birds, man. They're killing my birds. Can you come? Can you come quick?" Armed with my faith in God and the power of his name in the underworld, if not this one, I grabbed my Bible and hurried up to his apartment. He swung open the door before I could knock on it, or he was trembling uncontrollably. He was plastered to the wall, and sweat poured off of him as if he had been standing fully dressed in the shower. "They're killing my birds, man. They done kill my birds," he said, still plastered to the wall. With a dreadful scream, which was nearly a whisper, he said, "They in the kitchen. Look what they done to my birds." When I made the tentative turn into the kitchen, I saw two elaborate cages, one for his parakeets and another for the pigeons. There were three parakeets and six pigeons, and all of them lay dead on the floor of the cages, except one. One of them was hanging upside down on the swing in the cage, as motionless as the others, but simply hanging there ominously. Still plastered to the wall, he screamed, "Why y'all kill my birds?" I began to pray in earnest for minutes, seconds, hours, I don't recall. And he screamed again, "Y'all ain't had to kill my birds." And he fell to his knees. And from his knees, he said, "Did you see him? Did you see the arm? They gone now. The big one, he came and got him. Did you see the arm?" I had not seen an arm or any appendage. But suddenly, I heard the cooing of pigeons, the chirping of parakeets, and the flapping of wings. There is another world out there, filled with creatures unseen, unknown, and pernicious. I am not free of them, and neither are you.
That was Skip Stackhouse, a storyteller from Detroit with the Secret Society of Twisted Storytellers. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Joey Haran, Sarah Leeson, and Bella Isaacs. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in today for Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.